this recently, speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. East Chicago native and resident Guy Rhodes lists his talents as a photographer as well as a lighting designer and a video producer on his resume, and that's what he does every single day. Guy was in South Korea when he was stationed right in the middle of the Winter Olympics. He was taking dramatic and sometimes artistic photos of some of the skiers and the snowboarders who were in competition for the gold. And Guy joined us in the studio to talk about himself and his work.
Born and raised in East Chicago, and I've always been fascinated with light. When I was a little kid at the circus, I remember paying more attention to the follow spot operators than the people in the rings. My mom has a Christmas list from that same age where I was asking for spotlights and dry ice. So whenever I question whether this is what I'm supposed to be doing, I just kind of look back on that, and I think I'm on the right track. But I've always been fascinated with light, whether it's using a camera to capture light or whether I'm using stage lighting fixtures to shoot light out at performers to tell stories that way. It all comes back to light at the end of the day for me.
What got you interested in particular on a professional level to be involved in photography? Then we'll get to the lighting as well.
Well, it can be traced back to seventh grade, Block Junior High School, taking pictures for the yearbook. And I think that's really where I learned that photography could be used as a storytelling tool in addition to showing people the beautiful things in the world that I notice all the time. So that continued throughout high school at East Chicago Central with David Lane and the Central Perspective newspaper. And then I went on to freelance for the Post Tribune here in Northwest Indiana. I shot heavily for them for 11 years or so. During that time, I met a good friend of mine named Mark Rabilis. He's a photographer from Phoenix, Arizona, and he introduced me to USA Today Sports Images. Got to know the editors there. They really liked my work. And when the 2010 Olympics rolled around in Vancouver, they asked if I wanted to be part of the team. I said yes, and I've been asked back for every Olympics since.
When you got involved in photojournalism on the news side, what was it that intrigued you the most about rushing out with the camera and gear and covering stories, as well as the scheduled events, like the sporting events and things like that?
I think one thing that I really enjoy about shooting spot news, that's what we call it when you go shooting a house fire or an accident or something like that. You have to think on your feet. You have to deal with the logistics of street closures and things like that and not making firefighters angry because you're standing too close. You kind of have to feel the situation out. And in a way, in those situations, there is beauty to be found too. Just last week, I shot a house fire in East Chicago, and it was 1:30 in the morning, and there's this full moon and this midnight blue sky above these barren trees, and then below that is this glowing orange house with this white smoke coming out of it. And just the contrast between those two worlds through my viewfinder was really striking. So I think that's one thing I really enjoy about shooting news like that, is that even in these situations that are inherently really bad, there is still beauty to be found in those frames.
Now, when you take it from the spot journalism that you're talking about there to the sports events and things like that, and that in turn, of course, obviously will lead into what you've done for the Winter Olympics, because this is not your first. What's the difference that you see between covering spot news and going to sporting events?
Well, with both, I think the goal is to share with the viewer a certain finite moment in time that tells the story. So if it's a high school regional basketball game and it's second overtime and there's that pivotal moment, that pivotal play, my job is to freeze that action, that moment, so people can see that play that really tells a story of what happened there. Much like at the fire or the accident scene, you might be photographing somebody being extricated from a car, and that's the moment that tells that story. So I guess at the end of the day, my job is really to decide which of those moments most effectively tells a story, and that's what I share with the viewer.
Now, before we get back to the Winter Olympics, let's talk a little about your work as a lighting designer. What got you, besides the youthful wanting to look at the follow spot at the circus, what got you interested further in getting involved in stage lighting?
Well, when I got to high school, Chester Gregory, who has since gone on to star in several Broadway productions, was my drama teacher / tech crew teacher in the auditorium. And I can remember going on the first orientation tour of the auditorium my sophomore year and seeing the lighting board and just telling Chester, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, and basically just threw it at me. And the rest is history. The interesting thing about lighting for stage, it's a lot like looking through a viewfinder of a camera. If you think about the opening of the stage, that's right. Kind of your frame. And you're using lights to basically control where people are going to look on the stage. It's a lot like pointing a camera at a scene that's before you in the world. So again, in my brain, there's not a whole lot of difference between the stage lighting and the photography and video work that I do. It all has to do with controlling where people are going to look in the frame to best tell the story.
I was going to ask here, in respect to the fact that you do video work as well as still photography, and you just referred to that here, what is the difference to you that you found in doing lighting design for video, television for that matter, or other video work for that matter, and stage?
Well, lighting design for video is a lot more about the finite details that we can't see on the stage. When I'm doing a video interview, for instance, I will set up a light near the camera lens to just put a little highlight in somebody's eye, just to make their eye stand out. And when you're 50 feet away on a proscenium theater stage, you really can't get into that much detail. So it's kind of fun when you're doing video to be able to take the things that we do on stage with lighting and you kind of ramp them up, and you can get really, really detailed with what mm-hmm. you're doing. It's a lot of fun.
We're talking with Guy Rhodes, who is an East Chicago native. He's a resident of the city as well. He's a photographer. He's a lighting designer. And most notably, he's been among many photographers who have been able to journey to the Winter Olympics in Seoul, outside Seoul, South Korea, for the games here, then just come back here and try to work off the jet lag and all of that, I imagine. First, tell us about the excitement of being able to get involved in that. Once again, this is not your first Winter Olympics that you've covered, I understand.
No, this was my third Winter Olympics and my fourth Olympic Games. I did the Summer Games in Rio 2 years ago. It's always a thrill to have a front row seat to the athletes who are competing in events that they have trained their entire life for. In some ways, there's a parallel with my photography work because I've been training most of my life to perfect my photography craft. So while I'm not an athlete, I like to think that I kind of know what that's like. So to have a front row seat to people winning gold medals, you get the chills every time. It's a fantastic opportunity. And to be able to share those images with the world, it's the icing on the cake.
We've referred earlier to your photography work for the Post Tribune for the years, and what you still do now on occasion. In doing your sports photography work, did that help prepare you in a way for covering the Winter Olympics? It's more than just a regular sporting event.
Absolutely. The high school sports that I photographed here in Northwest Indiana, just that training that you get of how to cover a sporting event absolutely carries over to the Olympics. The Olympics, you have to be a little more I don't want to say resourceful, but you have to take care in where you're going to set up to photograph a certain event, because unlike high school sports, the Olympics is actually a lot more restrictive of where you can stand and where you can be to photograph a certain event. So actually, in some ways, photographing high school sports is easier because you have more access. When you're at the Olympics, you can stand here and you can stand there, and that's it.
Yeah.
So you have to be very creative with those photo positions to get good backgrounds behind the subjects and to really isolate the athletes.
I suppose that would be no different than going to Wrigley Field and shooting a Cubs game, where you would only get certain shots because you have to be in certain places there, I would imagine.
Exactly. And also just knowing what shots you need to have.
Mm-hmm.
At a high school event, it's no different than shooting an NFL game, where you want to have shots of the coaches, you want to have the offense and the defense. You want to tell the whole story of the event, and that carries over really with any sport that you shoot.
All right, now let's get to South Korea now. Tell us about your prep work that you did and getting ready to make the trip to South Korea, and then when you finally arrived, you got there several days before the actual opening of the event.
Right. So my Olympics prep starts a couple days before I leave, with making sure that I have all my gear in order. And then obviously packing enough clothes to be outside in the elements for try to go 2 weeks without doing laundry, because there isn't a whole lot of time to do that there. So once you're on the ground, they give you a couple days to get the lay of the land, have some meetings with the other photographers you're going to be working with, and from there it's off to the races. I think one of the most difficult parts of this Winter Olympics for me, it was the first one that I've done where it was actually cold. In Vancouver, it rained the whole time. In Sochi, I shot cross-country skiing in a t-shirt and jeans. So this was the first one where the weather was a lot like it's been here this winter, but there's something about the cold in South Korea that's different. They call it the knife wind over there, and it cuts through you to your bone.
And I understand that was also a problem for some of the events as well, too, that had to be postponed because it was so windy for a long time.
Right. Alpine skiing was postponed a number of times. My venue, which was the Extreme Park, so half pipe snowboarding and skiing, snow cross racing, slope style, those are the events that we covered. We had a slope style event that was postponed also because of the wind. The most difficult one for me was men's mogul skiing finals at night. The temperature was in the low teens with wind chills in the minus side on the Fahrenheit scale. These are the wind chills that people here have news stories about. They cancel school for. And over there it was, yeah, Olympics, let's go. And so I can remember standing up on the mogul's hill. I had hiked up to this really precariously steep position, and I couldn't feel my hands. I couldn't feel my feet. You can't go inside because you'd have to hike all the way down to get to anywhere warm. So you kind of just have to get in this zen-like state of forgetting how uncomfortable you are to do what you have to do. The cameras that I use are like holding a block of metal, which doesn't really help the cold very much. So it was tough.
Did you have any opportunities while you were there? Obviously, you're busy taking pictures, but did you have a chance to interact with any athletes?
Not so much the athletes. While I mentioned earlier that you have a front row seat, we don't really interact with the athletes directly. But again, seeing them up close, achieving their goals that they've trained so hard for, it's always a treat.
What would you say was the best event or the best events, I suppose, more than one, that you got the best pictures at that you will remember and maybe even those who actually saw your pictures in USA Today would see?
I really enjoyed aerials skiing, and that's an event where the skier comes down an incline and they hit these ramps, and the ramps are up to 70 degrees. So they're almost skiing up a straight wall, and they pop up in the air. It has to be over 50 feet in the air. And they do all these twists and turns, and they're judged based on what cool things they can do while they're flying through the air. For me, it's interesting because I get to play with being really artsy. It's one of the reasons that the editors actually ask me to go to the Olympics again and again. I often look for very abstract frames that feature graphic lines and saturated colors, and the aerials event had a lot of opportunity for that.
Do you think that gave you the best opportunity to get the best pictures actually published because it was something different than the typical sports journalistic picture?
I think so. And I think that at that event in particular, it allowed me to work really hard to find those unique frames. At the Olympics, as I mentioned, access is sometimes limited. They want to pen you in these areas, and you're standing shoulder to shoulder with 40 other photographers who are using the same camera and the same lens. That means they're getting the same picture as you. And the whole reason that I'm there is to try to find that unique frame. And with the aerials course, there was a lot of room to walk around and to try different things. So that's one thing I really liked about it.
Now that you're back from South Korea and trying to get your body back on schedule, making the flights back and all, getting rid of the jet lag, what do you get to do these days? That's obviously, it's a lot different than covering the Olympics.
It is. The jet lag has been a big adjustment. South Korea is 15 hours ahead of us. So coming back here, where I'm usually a night owl, having to exist on a morning schedule here for the work that I've come right back into doing, it's been challenging. This weekend in Minneapolis, I lit a Russian wedding, which was a lot of fun, and then flew right back here yesterday to go into rehearsals for Sister Act at the Hammond Academy for Performing Arts at Morton High School.
That's great. Now, all these great pictures you've taken of the Winter Olympics in South Korea are in your camera. Some of them have been published in USA Today and other publications, I'm sure. If anybody would like to take a look at some of the ones that you feel that are the best ones that you could ever offer, how could they check them out now?
They can visit my website at guyrhodes.com. They can see my blog there that I tried to keep up with the best I could while I was in South Korea, and also on my Instagram at guy_rhodes.
And you felt it was more important to keep the blog updated than having to do laundry, I suppose, when you're over there, right?
Well, it was laundry, sleep, or blog, and that was really tough choice a lot of days, but I tried to get all three done.
Guy Rhodes, thank you for spending time with us, telling your story and telling us the stories that you got to witness firsthand through the lens of the camera, and you got to be able to send on to others here in the United States. I'm glad you spent some time with us to tell us about it, and the best of luck to you and whatever comes. It has to be less exciting, I'm sure, than the Winter Olympics, but maybe in a way it's all fulfilling, isn't it?
Everything I do is very rewarding. So you take every opportunity that you get, and you enjoy it.
Guy Rhodes, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
I'm once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Ian Hurt. He's the port director for the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor. Ian, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Carl. Glad to be here.
So, you know, Ian, most people don't have access to our ports, meaning they haven't really seen what the operations is and what it all entails. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Port of Indiana and what goes on in the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor?
So at the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor, we have approximately 25 companies. They primarily want to have a need to have move cargoes across water. So that's really where a port comes into play is, you know, companies that are looking to take transportation costs out of moving their goods to market. And water is always the cheapest way to move cargo. So if you can move it by water, you're probably going to save some money and make you that much more competitive. So out at the port, we have approximately 25 businesses that handle things like grain, so corn from northwest Indiana, soybeans. We move a lot of steel products, semi-finished steel products, as well as the raw materials that go into making steel, that go into the mills here along the lake. We have 7 different steel processors that will take steel coils and improve them somehow. They will cut them into steel sheets. They will cut them into strips, and eventually they'll go into making things like refrigerators or paint cans or toasters. Things that we use every day, a lot of that steel will come in through the port, or the raw materials will come into the port that'll end up making those things. We have we handle cargoes like limestone and coal and slag, a wide variety of things. And there's also, you know, the reason that people want to use a port is because there's tremendous cost savings by moving by water. A good example is if you have one tugboat pushing 4 steel barges, and a steel barge is like a big empty steel box. I can carry about 6,000 tons of cargo. Well, that equals 300 trucks.
I see.
So you get a lot of cost savings. You know, a tugboat has a small crew on it with a couple people, as opposed to 300 trucks that have 300 drivers, that have 300 engines that can go bad, things like that. So if you can move it by water, in addition to being the cheapest way to do it, it's also the most environmentally friendly way to move cargo.
Sure it is. Yeah, absolutely. So how's the port working to reduce its impact on greenhouse gas emissions from the various types of vehicles that you just described?
So what we want to do is we want to get those old diesel engines out of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So working with companies like yours, South Shore Clean Cities, you know, if we can get those 1998 forklifts out of service that have the old Tier 1 engines that really emit a lot of emissions into the air, get them replaced with the newer engines, Tier 4, I think Tier 5s are coming now, they really emit a lot fewer emissions. And so our tenants who are running things like payloaders and forklifts and cranes, again, a lot of it's older equipment. We want to get that old equipment out. For the Port Authority itself, we just have kind of a small fleet of pickup trucks, that type of thing. But again, there we're looking to go to alternative fuel vehicles. So, you know, maybe just having a hybrid pickup truck instead of a diesel-powered pickup truck, something like that.
Sure. So I saw the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor recently broke tonnage records for the second consecutive year. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
So there's really 3 drivers that will cause tonnage to grow. Okay. So one is you have good companies at the port that their customers like them and they want to do business at the port. So we have a lot of those. We have a lot of good companies that do a good job at a good price. So their customers want their cargo to move through them. The second way that we can do it is with a strong economy. So you're rarely going to set tonnage records when the economy is doing bad. The two just don't go very good together. And the third way that we're able to do that is the port itself is about 600 acres. We currently have about 500 acres under lease to various different companies, different tenants. So we have 100 acres that's available to bring in more companies and bring in more tenants. So we want to find companies that are going to move cargoes across the water, have them come in, and then, you know, that'll drive up tonnage with they have to bring in 100,000 tons a year of cargo to come to the new facility.
Well, I know you have a major expansion plan at your facility. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we received $9.85 million from the federal government in a Fastlane grant. So when you hear people talking about the infrastructure, you know, they want to drive infrastructure projects, this is one of them that's going to happen. The port and our tenants, we're also going to contribute about $9.85 million, so a little under $20 million total.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
It's going to go into five projects. Two of those are going to be rail yards that will increase the capacity of rail that we handle at the port, bring it up another 185 rail cars. And what that does is it allows our tenants to stretch their footprint into the hinterland for delivering those cargoes further out. So rail is much more cheaper way to move cargo than by truck.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get more rail in, that kind of expands your footprint and allows you to move your cargoes farther and still be cost competitive. The other three projects, one of them is we're going to improve about 1,200 foot of dock, give us two more berths for loading and unloading barges and ships.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one is going to be improving our bulk unloading area. So when you have raw materials that come in like coal or limestone, things that move big piles of cargo, what we want to do there is go with more conveyors. It moves things quicker and easier.
Sure.
And more direct. You don't have as many equipment breakdowns. And the last project is going to be a truck marshaling yard where we're going to have trucks parking in one spot as opposed to kind of all over the place.
Sounds exciting. Sounds like we're going to create some more jobs here in Northwest Indiana also.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these five projects are going to take a lot of construction jobs to get them all built. And then with these infrastructure improvements, then we'll hopefully be able to attract more tenants, fill up that 100 acres I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
get those more companies in and get longer lasting full-time jobs that are usually jobs at ports are good paying jobs. So
mm-hmm.
that's a good thing to have.
Well, I know in these plans that you're talking about, are there like sustainable options? Again, we're trying to talk about green things and the different things to reduce emissions, reduce fuel and things like that. So in our expansion plans here that you're talking about, can you talk just a little bit about some of the sustainable options that maybe you're looking at?
So two of the projects we definitely think are going to be very sustainable. The one is the truck marshaling mm-hmm. yard. What we're looking to do there is right now we have these 25 businesses, and they all have trucks loading and unloading their facility. So you'll get a line of trucks, 5, 6, 7, 10 trucks in line. And as one truck gets loaded and unloaded, all the remaining trucks in line all inch forward 500 feet or 50 feet. And then they keep their engines idling the whole time they're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cold outside, it's hot outside. They want to be in the comfort of their climate control cab. What we want to do is build this marshaling yard, get all the trucks to park in one spot, and then we'll build a trucker's lounge so that they'll get out of their trucks, they'll go into the lounge, they'll have the comfort of an air-conditioned room
mm-hmm.
or a heated room, they'll have a television, they'll have a place to sit down, stretch their legs, and then they'll be able to communicate directly with the companies inside the port. We'll then notify them that, okay, it's your turn now, come get loaded. Then they'll go to their truck, they'll go in, they'll get loaded or unloaded, and then they'll move on. So instead of idling for an hour or two waiting in line, they'll be parked, their engine will be turned off. And, we handle about 1,000 trucks a day through the port. So if we can get 10% or 20% or 30% to mm-hmm. use that's that many trucks that are going to be idling that much less. The other project that should have some sustainability will be the bulk unloading and loading facility mm-hmm. that we're going to be building, that dock. By utilizing conveyor systems instead of payloaders, again, the payloaders are older diesel engines burning a lot of fuel. These conveyor systems may be electric, or at the very least, they're going to burn a lot less fuel than these diesel engine payloaders. Because the loader unload a ship, you're going to be running 5, 6 payloaders at a time. Here, you're just going to turn on one conveyor system.
Sounds very exciting. And if people like to learn more about what's going on in the port, can you give them your web address?
Sure. It's www.portsofindiana.com, ports with an S, Ports of Indiana. And we also have a quarterly newsletter. There'll be a link on the website so you can get the most recent information by clicking on that. And you can always give our office a call. We're here to serve the community. We mm-hmm. want to be out there in the community and letting people know what's going on at the port.
Well, Ian, congratulations, and we look forward to having you on future shows to give us an update on what's going on at our great port here. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Ian Hurt, Port Director for the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor. Green Fleet Radio airs 3 times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
And Green Fleet Radio, made possible, that is, by South Shore Clean Cities. And you can catch Green Fleet Radio here on Regionally Speaking on Wednesdays. And the podcasts for the program are also online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. First opening in 1904, Ravinia Festival is the oldest outdoor music festival in the United States. And Ravinia Festival is planning for a very special season beginning in May. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with the president and CEO, Wells Kaufman, about the big plans, about the debuts and the celebrations that are on deck for the summer of 2018.
Everybody that I've talked to at Ravinia last year who was there having a good time, they all had such positive things to say.
That's great.
They love the talent that was there. The shows that I went to, you got a huge turnout for them. So congratulations on your continued success.
Well, knock wood, right? And hope that can continue.
Oh, totally.
You never know. But
yeah.
Man, is it a fun place to work. As I've told you before, I'm just the luckiest guy in the world. Such a beautiful place, such a great staff, such a marvelous audience who are adventurous and hungry for new things, and they want the standard things, and they want the traditional things, and, you know, but they're willing to take a chance, whether it's on a pop artist they've never heard of, or a classical piece they've never heard, or, you know, whatever it might be. It's pretty cool.
It's nice that you have such a variety. You appeal to,
yeah,
like, all tastes.
Yeah.
I was, yeah, really impressed with last year was, you know, lead singer Switchfoot did like a street show outside of the gates. That was really cool. I'd never experienced,
yeah,
anything like that before. So,
great.
So, yeah, what you got going on this year?
Well, there's a lot of wonderful stuff, a lot of artists who I've been trying to get for a long time, which we'll talk about. But first and foremost, this is the centennial year of the most important classical musician America's ever produced and probably ever will produce in our time, and maybe that the world's ever known, Leonard Bernstein. And not only because of his extraordinary output as a composer, you know, from West Side Story to his three symphonies to the Serenade for violin, which is basically a violin concerto, all the songs, et cetera, et cetera. He also was a great pianist, an amazing conductor who rediscovered or renewed a lot of standard work and unknown work for the classical canon. He was America's music teacher, no question about that, with, when you think about a 10-plus year run of primetime television about classical music, I mean, we can't even conceive of that today, you know? But to be on CBS every night at 8 o'clock, every week at 8 o'clock, I mean, it's just kind of astonishing. But, of course, that was his charisma, that was his passion, that was his huge brain, and teaching was hugely important to him. So when I say America's music teacher, I really mean that. So many people I know, including kids today, who are watching the Young People's Concerts that were televised, they're watching them on the internet, on the websites that are available, on even on VCR sort of machines, old stuff, really staggering. And then the last piece, the sort of fifth facet of this extraordinary man, was his social humanitarian bent, his social equality focus. Someone who put quite deliberately and very controversially African-Americans into his shows in the 40s with white and black people dancing together in On the Town. Doesn't seem radical at all today, but at the time, hugely so. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover had a 1,000-page FBI file on Bernstein. That's I don't know if that's a badge of honor or a mark of disgrace for our country, but this was hugely important to him, and especially later in life, as he did so much work around AIDS, as he was always bisexual. So sort of soup to nuts in terms of that, anti-Vietnam War. I'm playing a little concert of his vocal music with a young lady who is an alum of our vocal program here, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. This thing did another big milestone.
Oh, what's the name of that vocal program?
It's the Ravinia Staines Music Institute. So it's our piano and strings, jazz, and singers programs that started with piano and strings 30 years ago, and then we added voice and jazz after that. Lots of exciting things happening in all of that arena. Lots of free performances, some commissions. We have a competition in the jazz arena that I'm really excited about. And then there are just so many alums who are playing, quote-unquote, regular concerts within the confines of the festival who've become big stars. So we're very proud of that and want to show that off. There are great programs like this at Tanglewood and at Aspen and at Interlaken, but the Ravinia program, which is the youngest of all of those, is going great guns. And Bernstein would have loved it. He tried to start his own program like that at the Hollywood Bowl back in the 80s, and it never really took off for a variety of reasons that are silly to go into. But this extraordinary man who are celebrating through the curatorship of a wonderful conductor named Marin Alsop, the few female conductors out there today, and his last protege, and only female protege. So she's helped me for the last 4 years put together this summer from a standpoint of classical music, both the Chicago Symphony and our smaller theater chamber music and recital offering. Just a lot of really cool stuff. And as I say, I mean, so many of us who work in this business were inspired by him, but it's every facet of this extraordinary human being that we want to celebrate. And we'll probably do it over several years. There's too much to do in the constraints of one summer, and there's so much to celebrate. And in a lot of ways, Sharon, he's kind of a mirror for what we are musically, because he was a, you know, acclaimed Broadway composer. He wrote pop songs. He loved the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel, talked about that all the time. He was the teaching part, which is a huge part of the Ravinia mantra and philosophy. It's so interesting to hold him up and say, yeah, we do that. But I'm not sure we would have been doing it, quite frankly, without his power and his celebrity. Think of a conductor today who would have been hobnobbing with, you know, Paul McCartney and the Kennedys and the Black Panthers. And this was quite a force. He did an anti-Vietnam concert with a whole huge list of stars, he and Paul Newman. This is in the late 60s. Paul Newman, he co-hosted it, and he wrote a song for Barbara Streisand, and that kind of thing, which kind of gives me goosebumps and makes me feel like, where did all that go? Because we don't have that today. We've got wonderful conductors. We've got the greatest musicians in the world around us, but not that kind of phenomenon. So, as I say, we want to dig deep into all of that greatness. And, of course, the music is the place to begin.
Is Ravinia, I should say, having a concert for him or several?
Ooh, lots of concerts, lots and lots of concerts. So, great question. So, at our Staines Music Institute, the vocalist will be doing all of his songs over a couple of concerts. We're doing his gigantic music theater piece called Mass, which Jackie Onassis commissioned to open the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. in the early 70s. That's really the mega event. Hundreds of people on stage, Chicago Symphony, rock musicians, rock singers, classical singers, full concert choir, children's choir. It's just a really astonishing piece that many people thought was a bit of a mess, more than a mass, when it opened, and now it's largely believed to be his masterwork. We're doing his serenade, his first symphony, Jeremiah, and then we're doing work by composers that, without Lenny, I don't think we would have today in the way that we do. Mahler being at the top of the list, but also Shostakovich and Stravinsky, Aaron Copland's music, people that he was great friends with, people whose music he loved, people who he thought were great teachers, and then the kind of forgotten works of Mahler. It's hard to believe when he started doing all the symphonies in the 50s and 60s that they really weren't being done that often. And now they're a regular part of what we think of as the classical canon. So lots of good stuff going on. His daughter, he has three kids who are with us, and his eldest daughter is coming to do a program of anecdotes and music in Bennett Gordon Hall for us, and she'll do some talks as well. She's also going to narrate her own young people's concert, all using her dad's music, which has not been done before. It's exciting. That's in July, sort of mid-season. So lots of cool things.
Amazing, the social awareness that Leonard Bernstein had. I was a little ignorant to that. I did not know that.
Many people don't, and there's good reason. You know, when someone is a celebrity conductor, but also, as you know, in the classical world, it's such a world of kind of rarefied air and, dare I say, arrogance and elitism, and sort of ivory towerishness. And he was criticized for writing beautiful music, writing tonal music. This is the 50s, 60s, 70s when everything was difficult and everything was 12-tone and everything was dissonant. But he stuck to his guns, not only with his own output, but also with his other American composer friends and Europeans. But the social piece, hugely important. I mean, like I said, I'm playing this song. It's called So Pretty, that was written specifically for Streisand and then for Lenny to play for her at an anti-Vietnam War benefit. It was actually a benefit to raise money for congressional candidates who were anti-Vietnam War. And that's why they had all these superstars. It was done at Lincoln Center in the 60s. And the song is absolutely stunning. And I'd not only had not heard it, I'd never heard of it until 2 weeks ago. So it's exciting to discover something new and fresh that you didn't know anything about from someone who's had such a gigantic impact. And I really want to make sure that the whole world is celebrating him. That's his fame, that's his power, that's his legacy. But I really want to do a lot of it at Ravinia, especially for kids, because I'm not sure in my lifetime we'll see another sort of superstar, you know, firecracker like this career and this impact. It's sad to say that, but you just never know. So let's take advantage of the moment, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all those things made him very special. Do you think he was such a superstar because of his musical talent and because of his social awareness and what he did, like an activism sort of thing? Or
I think it was all of that. And because Another thing that I think I lose sight of, and I should know better, is that he was the first great American conductor. All the conductors were European, all of them. That kind of makes sense. You know, if you think of the classical music canon, it's European music, right? It's Bach and Beethoven and Ravel and Debussy and Shostakovich and Mozart, Rachmaninoff. So that makes sense. So here's this guy who at 25 years old makes his unexpected New York Philharmonic debut and just takes off like crazy, all unbelievably thrilling. And I think the excitement around that then prepare, and he's a good self-promoter as well, handsome. You know, all of that figures in. One can't discount those pieces of someone's fame, whether it's a movie star or a politician or a musician or a visual artist or a sculptor. All of that is relevant. It's just that we've never had anybody like that before, and we haven't seen anybody like that since, except perhaps in his young years, because he's in his 30s. You've probably heard of a conductor in Los Angeles named Gustavo Dudamel.
Well, I heard of him from you last year,
yeah,
and I learned about him through you.
Him, right?
Yeah.
Had he yet, because the government of Venezuela canceled the tour that he was taking with his kids. Well, he's going to make his Chicago Symphony Orchestra debut at Ravinia this summer. He's conducted the CSO before, but never at Ravinia. So it feels kind of perfectly aligned that, you know, Bernstein Centennial, even though we're going to celebrate many over a couple of years, but this is the actual year that Dudamel would be coming to us for the first time. Just thrilling. I overweight the impact and the significance of that, but I do believe that the stars align for a reason, you know. And Gustavo is, I mean, this is charisma like crazy. I just heard him do the piece Mass that I was just describing to you that we're going to do this summer. He did that in L.A., and it was just phenomenal. And he's a nice guy, and he's writing music for Hollywood, and his wife's an actress, and he's the basis for that, I think it's a Netflix show, maybe Amazon show called Mozart in the Jungle. He's the model for the conductor in that, and it's interesting to see that it's not an American, but it's a Venezuelan, a Latin American. So Gustavo is also big on the teaching part because he comes out of the Sistema programs out of Venezuela. He's the superstar person, though there are other musicians who are coming out of that now. It's been going on for 40 years, a program that was all about social justice and taking kids off the dangerous streets of Caracas, putting instruments in their hands and having them sing. Extraordinary thing like what done in the civil rights movement in the U.S. certainly in Chicago, the Chicago Children's Choir. It wasn't meant to be a choir, it was meant, and but it is, of course, a wonderful musical organization, but it was really about putting black and white kids together at a challenging time in America. So I love all this stuff. I love the music. There's no question about that. And music is pure and stands on its own, and one can look at it, you know, in the clear light of day and enjoy it for what it is. But I do think the background of someone like a Bernstein might attract, instill in somebody who might not have looked at classical music to take a look. You just never know what's going to hit people.
Now, you answered my question before I was going to even ask it about Gustavo Dudamel.
Yeah.
You know, he came up through the Sistema program out of Venezuela, and you told me that last year. Yeah, because he was supposed to come last year, so got canceled.
He was doing a tour with the National Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, and the president of Venezuela and Maestro Dudamel got into a little bit of a contretemps because the president of Venezuela was really cracking down on the people of Venezuela. At least that was Gustavo's take. I'm not a Venezuelan. I've never been there. I don't really know, but that was the situation. So Maduro, the president, canceled the tour. He was supposed to go to Wolf Trap in Berkeley and a Hollywood Bowl into us. And so sadly it didn't happen. But we're thrilled to have him with the Chicago Symphony and the hugely remarkable pianist, Yuta Wang, who the Sting's alum, our summer conservatory, is super exciting pianist. And the two of them together, I've seen them do Bartok and Rachmaninoff and all sorts of things. It's really an event. That's an old Beethoven program coming up.
Just as a quick side note, what happened in Venezuela that has allowed him now to come here? Do you know?
Well, he doesn't actually live in Venezuela anymore, so he lives in Los Angeles. I think he might have another outpost in Berlin or London. And I'm sure there's a home in Caracas still. But it wasn't so much that he wasn't allowed to leave, it was his student kids who made up the orchestra that was supposed to tour last summer. They were not allowed to. Plus, we were getting worried that Trump, Mike Pence, went to Venezuela and said that we were going to attack them. You know, crazy talk. You know, who attacks Venezuela? It's not what you do in a diplomatic situation, a political situation. Nevertheless, that came up. And that really angered the Venezuelans. I can understand why. And so we thought maybe if this orchestra is allowed to leave Venezuela, you know, might they find themselves in a precarious position politically? Might they be used as a kind of political football, you know, between the U.S. government and the Venezuelan government? So it may have been a blessing, as disappointing as it was, that they were unable to travel. And they'll come some other time.
You guys do the Sistema program, the Ravinia Sistema program. That's still going on?
Absolutely. Growing all the time. So we're hoping to start New Nucleos. It's basically the name for site where one does this work. So we have one in the Austin neighborhood. We have one here at Ravinia. We're hoping to open one up in Lawndale. And the sky's kind of the limit, because it not only is a great way to bring music to kids, it's a great way to bring their parents to it as well, right? Because they're dropping them off for rehearsals and really engaged in something that is so intense. Maren Alsop, our curator for the Bernstein Summit this summer, she does a huge Sistema program herself at the Baltimore Symphony, where she's the music director. So it's kind of all nicely connected.
Very cool.
Yeah, no, exactly. It is cool. I mean, only because we had no idea the impact and the fast impact it would have. We knew Sistema was a wonderful thing to be doing. Time intensive, expensive, and all very well worth it. We just didn't know how quickly it would take off here. And of course, we've got these beautiful facilities, many of which are not well used in the wintertime, right? So it's great to have these facilities used by kids. And I love the fact that kids come and play in our halls, because, you know, you can play in your music room at your school or your multipurpose room at your school. It's not the same as playing in a professional theater. And there's a ramping up of excitement and desire to do well that comes with that environment.
What else did you want to mention in terms of what you guys got planned for this year?
The Means 30th and the Bernstein 100th are big. We've kind of covered the waterfront on those, which is great. It's just that you and I had discussed those in pretty good detail. So moving on from Bernstein and Stange for the moment, I really would like to point out a piece called Considering Matthew Shepard. 2018 is the 20th anniversary of the murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming. And of course, he became a martyr within the gay rights movement. Hideous situation all the way around. Wonderful group out of Texas, Choral Instrumental, have created a piece called Considering Matthew Shepard. We'll be doing the Chicago premiere of that piece in September. We also have the Los Angeles Master Chorale coming to do a Renaissance masterwork, the Italian of which I cannot repeat because I'll mangle it, but it's in English, Tears of St. Peter's. Absolutely glorious piece. That's also going to be in September. And then we have the debut of Sugarland, a band I've been trying to get here for a long time. We have the debut of Jason Mraz, a singer I've been trying to get here for a long time. We've got concert performances of The Who's Tommy with Roger Daltrey, which we've already announced, but very exciting to have an icon of rock and roll like that, and in that particular work. Plus, Greatest Hits of The Who on that same performance, two performances of that. We're doing a 50th anniversary of Jethro Tull, always a perennial favorite at Ravinia. Miss Diana Ross coming back to us after her debut a couple of summers ago. Angelique Kidjo, one of my favorite singers, she's coming with Femi Kuti. Lots of great chamber music concerts, lots of low-priced classical concerts, $10, $25 to enjoy the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. There's so much, Sharon. I'm sorry. I'm kind of bouncing around here in terms of how the season gets laid out. Pretty exciting. Yeah. Oh, Whoopi Goldberg in her debut at Ravinia. So a comedy evening with her. I'm very excited about that. Been working on that for a long time as well. Lots of great Baroque music. I'm an astonishingly gifted guitarist named Milos, who was with us a couple of years ago. He's coming back to play a recital in the Martin Theater. Do you know Lindsay Sterling?
No, I don't.
So Lindsay is a super gifted violinist who does kind of rock and roll violin and mashups as well. She's going to be with the band Evanescence. They're collaborating together with an orchestra.
That's cool.
Going to be the debut for both of those at Ravinia. Very excited about that. Jill Scott coming for the first time. Alison Krauss is coming back. Jackson Brown's coming back. Emerson String Quartet. Audra McDonald is our gala soloist with the Chicago Symphony. Lots of fun stuff. Lots of summertime stuff. Lots of super serious things like the Bernstein Centennial in general and the Matthew Shepard piece. But as you said earlier, you know, something for everyone. That's what we really try for.
Thank you so much, Wells.
A pleasure to talk to you always. Take care, Sharon.
The factors that lead to a housing crisis can be as simple as an unpaid bill, or they can reflect deeper issues that don't allow people to be able to break the cycle of poverty and be able to create a stable living environment. Creating opportunities for people to hold their capacity to stay housed and employed is one way to make sure that the cycle ends. And in the last story in the three-part series on low-income housing, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg examines on how tackling a housing crisis should be a holistic process.
During the second week of January, Indiana energy company Vectren announced that their customers would see, on average, a 30% increase to their bills from the same time period the previous winter. Bitterly cold temperatures caused a spike in gas deliveries. Vectren encouraged customers who might have difficulty paying to contact the company to arrange budget payment plans. But when a family lives paycheck to paycheck, their choices are already limited.
They're always having to make decisions in a crisis situation.
Pam Biggs-Reed is the executive director of Bauer Family Resources in Lafayette, which works with families who are struggling to stay functional.
It's what's the least bad choice, not what's the best good choice.
Bauer provides options like therapeutic services that help clients work through past and current traumas. But it also has funding that allows the organization to spend money on more concrete issues their clients face, like a high energy bill.
Sometimes paying an electric bill so a family stays housed is all the help they need.
But often the bill is just the surface problem. A closer look can reveal why the electric bill isn't getting paid to begin with, and that can range from poor budgeting skills to a more serious level of dysfunction.
So somebody comes in and says, "I can't pay my electric bill." And they're going to shut off the electric, so we get the electric bill paid, and we keep meeting with them, and we find out, well, they can't get the electric bill paid because their abusive partner took the money that was for the electric bill and bought drugs with it. That's a different issue to deal with than just turning on the electric.
For people managing a precarious housing situation, then, a holistic approach, which addresses more than just immediate physical needs, could help identify the underlying issues and work through more than one problem at a time. Stable housing first, but then what happens next? Lafayette's Food Finders Food Bank distributes food to 16 counties, but it also has an on-site grocery store where clients can come and shop for their meals. President Katie Bunder says they assess their clients for their level of food insecurity, but their needs might extend beyond that.
When they come in, we do an intake process the first time they come. And in that process, we will ask them a lot of questions about their family size, their income, their housing, their health care. We're trying to assess what services we might be able to help them get if they don't have them.
Food Finders also offers classes to its clients geared towards food and nutrition, the importance of exercise and healthy living, dealing with diabetes and blood pressure, meal planning and budgeting, even gardening. But she says education must also extend to the community so residents understand what's at stake for their neighbors who live in subsidized housing.
I also think that it's comfortable for people who've always been here to say that we don't have homegrown poverty. That's poverty from other places invading our town.
But Pam Biggs-Reed says some of the families with whom she works feel isolated and embarrassed by the awareness of their circumstances, and that while donations can help, so can a kind word to a mother in a grocery store trying to piece together the meals for the week.
If we truly believe that people's intent is to do the best they can, and we believe that human beings are flawed and can't always do the best they can because of things that happen in their lives, then how do we help them walk alongside them to help them do better, to take the responsibility that and provide the resources and support they need to overcome and do differently when they want to?
Lafayette residents in need of low-income housing grapple with a range of issues, from local governmental opposition to building more units, to misconceptions held by fellow citizens, to circumstances beyond their control, to their own sometimes problematic choices. Experts say the system isn't perfect, but learning how to work within its limitations is key. Everything depends on housing. Without that, any structure amounts to little more than a house of cards. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
A new study shows that over half of the communities in Indiana found population growth in 2017. Matt Kinghorn is a researcher on the IU study, and he says that that slow rate of growth following the Great Recession is finally speeding up.
People stopped moving around as much. Homes weren't being built. People were feeling less secure economically. And so fewer and fewer people were moving around, and so there's less migration to the state.
37 out of the state's 92 counties increased in population, with Lake County losing the most at nearly 1,000 residents. Kinghorn says there are changes, though there are noted around Indiana.
A lot of communities are, you know, focusing on quality of life initiatives, trying to have the amenities that will draw young people to the community.
Kinghorn says that Indiana has been experiencing low birth rates, and that, of course, slows population growth. But he says that the uptick in growth was caused by migration to the state. The survey found that Boone County in central Indiana had the highest rate of growth at 2.5% increase, followed by Hamilton County, also in central Indiana, at 2.4%. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, it's Thursday, of course, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. On the program, we'll have reporters Greg Tejeda and Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune. And we'll also have a special feature for you concerning Robert Kennedy when his speech in Indianapolis that happened on the same day, 50 years ago, that Martin Luther King was assassinated. Hope you'll join us for that.